A small boy stands in a Louisiana bedroom watching his great-grandmother, Ma'am Grace, take her final breath. He thinks it's her birthday party. When she dies, his mother runs outside screaming, throwing herself to the ground near the hog pen. The boy, too young to understand death but old enough to sense its weight, shoos away the hogs trying to lap at his mother's hair. This is Charles M. Blow's first memory: death, grief, and a child's instinct to protect what he cannot yet comprehend. Years later, in that same sacred room, another kind of death will occur, not of the body, but of innocence itself. This memoir doesn't just recount trauma, it excavates the architecture of survival, showing how we construct selves from the rubble of what breaks us. Growing up in 1970s Gippsland, Louisiana, Charles learns early that homes are promises, kept or broken. His father, Spinner, works construction, but never builds the porch steps his mother, Billy, constantly requests. Those missing steps become a metaphor for everything unfulfilled in their marriage: stability, presence, follow-through. Meanwhile, in Kibla, Arkansas, his step-grandfather Jed offers something revolutionary: unconditional love expressed through maple syrup eyes that saw into your darkness and drew up light. Jed teaches Charles to fish, whittle wood into whistles, and understand that masculinity can be gentle. At home, his parents' marriage combusts when Billy thrusts Spinner backward through the living room window. He clings to the yellow brocade curtains she'd sewn during better days, now torn and bloodstained. Young Charles witnesses a power shift. She was strong, he was weak. The family moves to Papa Joe's house, leaving his father behind. Loneliness wraps around Charles the way kudzu beside the road quickly overgrew the trees, encased them in shadows, and choked them to death. Desperately alone, he asks for a ventriloquist's puppet for Christmas, a 7-year-old boy creating voices for all the words he cannot speak aloud. At 7, Charles experiences sexual abuse by his older cousin Chester during a sleepover. The violation fundamentally disrupts Charles' sense of bodily autonomy and self. In the same room where Mom Grace had died, I too had died, just differently. Chester compounds the trauma through persistent psychological manipulation, using derogatory terms that attack Charles' masculinity, the most valued currency in their community. Charles' brothers either ignore the harassment or tacitly permit it, creating emotional distance to protect themselves from association. A year later, Uncle Paul, who had been a trusted figure teaching him to ride bikes and sharing simple joys, crosses boundaries while Charles sleeps. Unlike Chester's assault that fractured his spirit, Paul's betrayal devastates him emotionally because it comes from someone he loved. Charles engages in psychological denial, convincing himself of alternative explanations, learning the most useful and dangerous lesson a damaged child learns: how to lie to himself. This self-deception becomes simultaneously a survival mechanism and a form of imprisonment. These betrayals unfold within a family culture where love exists intensely but remains unspoken, expressed only through humor and masculine posturing. If love cannot be articulated directly, how could Charles possibly find language for trauma? The silence becomes both protective barrier and constraining force. At 8, Charles contemplates suicide with aspirin at a roller skating rink. His mother's rare song, "Take My Hand, Precious Lord," saves him. He takes this as divine intervention and walks the aisle at church to give himself to Jesus, though he hesitates at baptism, terrified of the burly preacher's violent-looking submersion ritual. Years later, when he finally submits, he emerges feeling nothing. "The angel hadn't troubled the water for me." As a teenager, Charles develops his own meditation practice, lying like the figure on the Shroud of Turin, imagining his spirit floating up to commune with a glowing Jesus. When Big Mama falls ill, he spends hours on his knees until he receives divine instruction to lay hands on her. Her recovery convinces him God works through him. Yet, despite fervent prayers, the male figures in his mind, the apparitions that visit at night, never disappear. His trembling fingers find Leviticus's stark condemnation of homosexuality in the family Bible. Though he isn't acting on these feelings, he fears his thoughts alone condemn him. After Chester's betrayal, Charles orchestrates meticulous self-transformation. His hyper-awareness of perception makes him feel as if his joints had bolts in them, turned half around too tight. At Gibbsland Elementary, he engineers acceptance through calculated athletic prowess and intellect, learning how to reduce others with just a look that conveyed disdain. He models himself after Martin Luther King Jr. and Prince Charles, adopting moral authority and aristocratic bearing. This performance peaks at Grambling State University during fraternity hazing, paddlings leaving inch-thick scar tissue. Charles approaches with supernatural detachment. I'd been fortified by past trauma. The link between me and my body had long ago been severed. As fraternity president, he perpetuates violence through underground hazing. Clarity strikes while chasing a fleeing pledge, suddenly seeing himself from outside, not as respected leader, but another link in trauma's chain. His question, "What am I doing?" reveals the cost. In fleeing his own pain, he'd become its messenger. Charles spends years trapped in self-questioning, wondering if he somehow invited Chester's abuse, or if Chester recognized something in him first. His first sexual experience with Roseanne brings unexpected clarity. The more I was drawn to girls, the less frequently male images appeared in my mind. Yet this revelation becomes both salvation and torment. Would his future relationships be authentic or carefully constructed defenses? During CIA recruitment, a lie detector test becomes a crucible of truth-telling. When asked if he'd ever had sex with a man, his no comes from careful rationalization. Chester and he were boys, not men. It wasn't consensual. There was no penetration. The machine's violent response suggests a deeper truth. More revealing, when he confesses everything and answers yes in a retest, the machine still indicates deception, crystallizing his fundamental uncertainty about his own truth. His exploration of male intimacy proves equally complicated. At a gay bar, he feels like an imposter. An encounter with a shoe importer becomes pivotal. When faced with male physical intimacy, his attraction dissipates completely. He reluctantly embraces the term bisexual, though it feels inadequate. His attraction to men remains in constant flux. Not a choice I was making, but a tide I was subject to. His marriage to Greta ends after 7 years and 3 children, partly due to these unresolved tensions, creating a permanent state of ambivalence that defies neat categorization. The memoir opens with Charles racing down Interstate 20, a loaded gun beside him, heading toward Chester's house. Tears flow from a walled-off place, from another time, from a little boy who couldn't cry. He believes removing Chester will excise the part of himself he despises. But at the Grambling exit, Charles chooses to turn away. His shaking hand calls a friend whose mundane conversation, work problems, relationship issues, weekend plans, creates enough distance from his rage to save Chester's life. This act sparks profound transformation. Charles realizes he must stop hating Chester to start loving himself. His world of rigid masculinity had taught him there was nothing worse than not being all one way, but his world had lied. He has to stop romanticizing the man I might have been and be the man I was, uniquely me, with no need for a cure because I had no infirmity. When he tells his mother about Chester's abuse, she collapses in tears. His emotionally distant father makes an unprecedented call. A small but significant breach in masculine stoicism. After leaving his pistol in Gibbsland in 1991, Charles heads north for internships, becoming the youngest newsroom department head at the New York Times before 25. He discovers his calling, advocating for vulnerable children who mirror his past self, addressing isolation, gun violence, dangerous hazing, and educators' critical roles. Charles M. Blow's journey teaches us that healing isn't about becoming whole in the way we imagined, but accepting the wholeness we already possess. The fire shut up in your bones isn't meant to be extinguished. It's meant to light the way forward.